What's wrong with you? Why are you assaulting me?
Do I not?
Why are you assaulting?
You shot prominence because you filmed an argument with your parents. It got quite intense.
Shut the fuck up, you parasite.
Your mother, from what I could work out, was your mother was on the phone, says, I don't know who, the police, saying my son is 22 and he's really right-wing.
Really right-wing?
Oh my God.
It's very difficult because I think the issue is they were brought up in a very different society. I don't think their generation fully understands me and my generation and our perspective on society, because even back in the 1970s where they were growing up, it's very different from where we are now. So I don't entirely understand why my mother rang the police, because if they mean by too radical is that I want to preserve my native ethnic group, I don't see that as too radical. I see that is the duty of an Englishman, is to look after England first.
Open the door, my house, I pay for this shit, why not?
Womp womp.
Why not?
Womp womp.
Oh my God, I pay for this house. I'm phoning 999, telling them to tell you. You are.
I'm what? I'm what? You're threatening me because we have a difference in opinion.
Me?
You're gonna smash the door open. Go on. Smash the door open then, do it. And what? Throw me out because we disagree? You're pathetic. I fucking hate you people. I always have.
Fucking hate
her. Yeah. How do you think they're gonna? How do you think Nana and Gran are gonna react? You wonder why they're so. Go and smash it open. We disagree. I want to preserve my people, and you want to hurt me because I want to preserve my people.
No.
Why? Smash the door open. Do it. Prove it.
To leave.
Prove it.
So open the door now so that you can.
No, if you want to smash the door open because I disagree about who should be in this country, do it. If you want to smash the door open because I disagree who should be in this country, do it. You go drunk and this is what happens.
Stop.
I can't. They live in Grimsby, mate. It's way too far away.
Do you want to leave?
No.
Why not?
Oh, you're not even showering me because you're drunk. I don't even understand. What is your problem? What is your problem? What is your problem?
No, because
you're not getting anywhere. You're going to regret this in 10 years' time when I don't speak to you anymore. You're going to regret this in 10 years' time when I don't speak to you anymore because you rejected me when I was right. You're going to reject this in 10 years' time when I have nothing to do with you. This is the end, okay. They're going to reject it in 10 years. Do it then, because you're trying to smash my door open, because I disagree.
Hello.
Oh, she's crying.
Radicalize.
What's your address? Concerned he's harming
I'm not harming myself.
What's your concern with him in his room?
I'm a political commentator.
Really right wing. He's posting stuff. Oh my God. He's shouting at us. He's like,
this
right.
Is so dramatic. You don't scare me, Dad.
Do I not?
No.
Do I not?
What is wrong with you? Why are you assaulting me?
Do I not?
Why are you assaulting me? Why are you assaulting me?
Shut the fuck up, you parasite. I have brought you up for fucking 20 years.
Let me leave.
What the fuck have you become?
Let me leave.
What have you become? I want you to leave. Jesus Christ, we're not.
Then let me walk out that door. Let me walk out that door. Let me walk out that door.
What?
Let me walk out that door.
Answer my question.
Nothing. I just want to preserve this nation. Do you not understand?
You will not win this war.
Yes, I will.
No, you won't.
I'm leaving this house.
I want you to leave. I don't want you to come back.
I'm leaving right now.
I want you to go right now.
I'm leaving
go.
Right now.
Go. Oh my God, I'm now leaving. He's filming.
No, I'm leaving.
Hugh, I have nothing to hide.
You're off to jail tonight, by the way.
Fucking yes.
You just assaulted me.
Hugh.
I want to leave. I want nothing to do with you.
Good Lord, off you go. Off you go. Don't come back.
Go away.
You want to smash
go door? Away.
You
want to smash what is wrong with you?
Don't come back.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, a very young guest on the scene of basedness. Who appears to have reached some prominence rather quickly, and that is Mr. Hugh Anthony. Hugh, hello.
Hello, thank you for having me on, Edward.
So just before we started, you were telling me a bit about your sort of how you got into this, as it were. So you were saying you were doing A-levels in, was it politics, what did you say?
Yeah, I did A-levels at politics, and then I did citizenship at GCSE, which is like baby watered-down politics.
Right, and then what did you go to university?
Yeah, I went to university. I actually decided to study psychology at university because I like understanding the human brain. I like understanding behavior. I'm very big into philosophy as well, so that kind of like resonated with my understanding of human nature.
Where did you go?
I went to Manchester Metropolitan, just a mark off of Manchester University itself.
Well, yes, I had a friend that went to Manchester years ago. I stayed on Oxford Road one night in about the year 2000.
That's very culturally enriched area now, I'd say that.
That's where he was living, Oxford Road, and he was once mugged on that road.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, it's not the best of areas. Okay, and so, but you talk about psychology, and I think one of the more interesting things that seems to have emerged about you is that you have undergone it seems almost like a conversion, a radical shift in self. You've talked about how I was a lustful man. I was a sinner. So what did you used to do that was so sinful, and how did this change?
Well, I think especially with the society that like my generation is growing up now, where you've got like pornography that's constantly at your disposal, with drugs, massive drinking culture, you've kind of got all of these things that can manipulate people into bad situations. So, I mean, I partake in homosexual acts, I partake in drug taking, in heavy drinking, that kind of thing. And it never makes anybody happy. But from being within those kind of communities and those areas and then being able to step away from it and understand like the degeneracy that is rampantly affecting my generation, it made me question, well, this is not normal, nor is this how nature and life is supposed to function. This is simply a distraction that nulls down the human brain, and it makes people almost idiots and like robots in a system that uses to control them.
So I'm sorry, I mean, forgive, as a person that's 20, well, how much older I am than you, 23 years older than you, I don't know how much older I am than you, tell me about the pressures that you feel that you're under then in before this change took place that made you behave like this.
Yeah, so I mean, I was always quite a quiet kid. I didn't even have my first sip of alcohol till I was 19 years old. But especially with going to university and being involved in like social groups and wanting to fit in with people, that involved me trying to, you know, go out and drink heavily. And because considering I hadn't drunk in my life, I was not very good at controlling it, which led to bad situations, me putting myself in weird environments, surrounded by people that were bad influences on me, giving me things that were not good for my health. And that kind of experience led me to realizing this is not what I want to do whatsoever, nor is it who I am as an actual person. You are molding me away from who I actually am.
Right. And so what you're saying, what they encouraged people to experiment with drugs and homosexuality and things like that? Was that the situation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of these things do come from pressure. I think a lot of them as well. It's like, especially like the drug culture, because people, you know, you're on a night out, people be like, oh, do this, take this, put it in your drink, whatever. that is definitely pressure, because it's the idea of like having as much fun as you can. It's like being part of the crew. And if you don't do that, you're seen as weird. When it comes to like the homosexuality, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I in the last like year or so, I've kind of come to my own conclusion that a lot of people that confirm themselves as homosexuals are not actually homosexual. They're just very lustful, deviant sexual creatures that have committed sodomy. So they make that their identity. And because they've made that their identity, they fall into these categories where they think that they need to advocate for rights regarding those things, when most of these people actually just need a little bit of support and a little bit of help to get out of those lifestyles.
And were you quite fervent in your, shall we call it, wokeness, or whatever we should call this set of beliefs and activities? Were you quite a sort of evangelical in that regard?
Well, so regarding my politics, like I used to be a libertarian. I was always like a baseline conservative, but I guess like my social values began to be altered because of the people that I was like surrounding myself with. I went through a period where I was supporting trans people and whatnot. And I look back on that now and I'm like, well, that's just idiocy. That's just supporting delusion. So I suppose so. Yeah. But you do it because everyone around you is so woke with these kind of things. They're so like socially liberal and accepting of like all these delusions and degeneracy and all of that, that to not offend people because you don't want to be kicked out the social groups, you do try and like fit in with them, even though if deep down, like I did, you know, that's not who I am, that's not what I believe.
So what was the sort of the roadmap via which you began to move away from that, via which you began to change your mind, radically change your mind?
So I was doing my psychology at uni, and I just began to detest everybody around me, because it was like the same thing every single weekend. It was drugs, it was alcohol, it was drugs, it was alcohol. And I got to a point where I just realized, what is the point in doing any of this? So because I'm quite philosophical with these things, I was like, well, where does it stop? Am I going to get to the age of, because I was friends with people that were in their 30s that were still doing it. And I was like, am I going to get to their age where they're just going out all the time doing drugs and drinking? And I just wanted better for myself. So I guess the point where it got to the worst bit is I was actually at a concert. And I was surrounded by all these horrible, nasty individuals, this group of women that were just really bitchy towards everybody around them. And I just was like, why am I even here? I don't want to be here. I'm not really that interested in going to these concerts anyway. So I kind of took a moment of reflection. I actually went to the bathroom in this arena. It was actually the Manchester O2 Arena. And I just went, what am I doing with my life? Why am I even doing this? This is not what I'm interested in. I don't like these people. And I know that I don't like these people, but I'm trying to fit in with them so that I feel like I'm accepted in a social group. So it was from that moment, about June 6th of last year, really, that I just decided, sod all of you. You people have never been my friends. You're very fair, fickle friends. You don't actually care about me. You care about what I give you. You care about the social experience. You care about the drug usage and all of that. You don't care about me or what happens to me. So I just decided to take a massive radical step away from it and completely shift myself back into my old form of like actually being an individual.
Of actually being an individual, but you also talk about being conservative. So had you previously been, before you went to Manchester Metropolitan University, had you previously been more conservative in your views?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I used to be a member of the Tory party. I supported Donald Trump in his first presidency. I always thought he was a very interesting character, even to the point where inside of my A-levels, I was the only conservative in the room. I was literally arguing with the entire class. And I was like, you know, I was pulled faces whenever a stupid topic came up or somebody suggested something ridiculous. So I was always the most conservative for these things. And I grew up in a conservative household, maybe not as socially conservative as I am now, but I grew up in a conservative household and my family is always very conservative. So I was always a bit more conservative, yes.
Right. So it's so there was something about a brief period at university where what you felt, I mean, you did the psychology degree, you should know about this, where you felt under a sufficient degree of pressure that you completely altered your identity and your views. Were there not fellow conservatives at this university?
Not particularly. I mean, considering you're doing a psychology degree, most people on your course are women, foreigners, or homosexuals. So they are quite liberal with what they're doing. I'm sure there were a few, but considering it mainly just stuck to like my housemates, who were all very liberal, they were like very like southern countryside, very liberal individuals. Everybody around me was very, very liberal. The only conservatives that I actually had in my life were my parents at that point in my time. So it was a very different environment. And you're right about the psychology thing. It's like the in and out groups. It's about like social cohesion, where you want to, you know, be part of a social group. And if you're in the out group, then you're perceived as like bizarre. And I mean, even as I get now, it's like, oh, this weirdo, this, you get called all these labels and all of that because you have a difference in opinion to what is deemed as the social norm. But I don't actually think that's a bad thing anymore. But I think especially a lot of young people, and I did, you don't want to be seen as that because you want to fit in with the rest of the crowd, but it's not a bad thing not fitting in with the crowd.
So you've moved between being from being conservative with a small C, a large C, because you were a member of the Conservative Party as a teenager, to being very, very left-wing and woke, to being now what your critics would call, you know, far right or whatever, to the extent that you rather seem to model yourself on Nick Fuentes.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I know. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, so even though, like, I was more woke in my social perspectives, regardless of that, I mean, I still voted for Reform last year. And like, I was still like conservative with that. And I've always been iffy about immigration. I've always understood that social cohesion between different ethnic groups does not actually fit in. And I actually could see that from going out to these areas and involve myself with these groups. I was always still skeptical of the idea of mass migration. I was always still skeptical of these social ideas. And again, as I said earlier, when I was actually thinking about like the social groups and what I was deeming as acceptable, such as transgenderism, I look back on that and I was like, well, I already knew deep down it wasn't correct. And with the whole like Fuentes thing, like I regarding like most like the based red pill, I guess I was basically based red pill because I was like watching these kind of things back in 2020. And then as I went to uni, I began to watch it less, but it was still there where I'd involve myself. But I guess from my personality, like I am a jokey camp man. So that also plays into it as well.
So when you say, for example, Christ is king, what do you mean by that?
I think that Christ is our Lord and Savior. I think that it's undeniable that the Bible is factual. I mean, things like the Shroud of Turin prove Christ's existence. I think that 500 witnesses watching him resurrect after being crucified on the cross, I think it's absolutely undeniable that Christ is king. Christ is the king of heaven. And if you follow him and you believe in him, that you will go to the kingdom of heaven.
But you say it's interesting. I mean, you say absolutely undeniable. So it's certain. It's you're certain of this.
In my personal belief, I'm absolutely certain that Christ is king. Yes.
Yeah, and but then presumably, when you were in your phase of being woke at Manchester Metropolitan University, you also perhaps felt reasonably certain of that you were right. Then,
well, I think there's a difference. You can attach yourself to the flesh, which I think is what that is, where you're attaching yourself to the people around you, the physical reality of the world, and then you can also attach yourself to the soul. And I think when you attach yourself to the soul, that's when you begin to find things more spiritually, which is like Christ. Christ is the spiritual connection and the relationship that I have with God and Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's the difference between it. It goes back to the idea of like lust. So lust is not of the soul, it's of the flesh. You're looking after the physical and the now and the pleasure that you can get from that. It's very different from the spiritual connection you can have spiritually.
But did the sort of the nihilism, or whatever we should call it, that you experienced when you went through your woke phase when you were at university, or part of when you were at university, did that kind of feel as real in a way as the feeling that you now have a year later or so, that Christ is king and that's that?
Not necessarily. Number one, I think that especially when you spend most of your days not fully with it, considering of the substances, you don't actually have an understanding of reality. And I think that there is a disillusionment when it comes to those kind of environments, because what you're actually doing is putting pleasure as the forefront of your reality. And if pleasure is the forefront of your reality, then you're not actually living. When I say Christ is king, I say Christ is king because he gives me life. And I view life as the most important thing in all forms of humanity. I've done a lot of like my vlogs where I walk in the woods and I give a chat to the camera and I talk about identity and the soul and the understanding of what needs are. And I think that when you're, especially uni students, when they're involved in these like cultures because they're looking at the pleasurable aspects, that they are no more than slaves to their own desires. They are looking at what they can get from everything around them rather than recognizing that they have everything they need inside of them because they've been given the life and the soul to be able to live.
Yeah, but you're a bit like St. Paul then, aren't you? You've kind of gone 180 degrees. You've gone...
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could say that. I mean, I suppose that everybody has their different ways in which they meet Christ. Some people are born into religious families and they meet it through that kind of like teaching as they're growing up. Some people do go through big change in their life where something happens or it's like a period of time happens that pushes them in the direction of wanting to find more and wanting to find their soul and spiritually connected to something. And some people will find Christ. Some people may find other religions or whatnot. But in my case, I found Christ. And I mean, I went to a Church of England school. It's not like I hadn't been involved in religion before. My family was not massively religious. They were fairly secular. My grandparents are somewhat religious and do believe in Christ. So it's not like Christ wasn't in my life. It's just I'd never explored it fully.
Yeah. And so, I mean, as a person that studied psychology, then what do you, I mean, it's quite an unusual thing to have a dramatic, you know, such a radical change in identity. And so it's like, it reminds me of, you know, William James, the religion of the sick soul. As a person that's doing this or done a psychology degree, or what do you think about what mechanism, what predictive structure summarizes what it is that you kind of are?
Well, I would actually say the radical change doesn't come from me going from being indulgent in sin and lust and all of that up until where I am now. I'd say that being indulgent in sin and whatnot was the radical change from who I was before that. Because before that, I was, again, conservative, very like socially conservative with those kind of things as well. And then I radically changed into this thing. So if anything, again, I think it goes back to the idea that psychologically, because I was trying to mold myself to be something that I'm not, that it kind of gives you like an identity crisis. Because again, deep down, you know that's not who you are. Deep down, that's not what you want. But because you're trying to fit into all of these norms and the perspective of what is acceptable to your peers, that you do put yourself in the cohesion where you want to change yourself for the benefit of the pleasurable aspect. So I think, again, this is something that we're going to see a lot more in this generation, because people do want to try and fit in with each other. They do want to try and fit in with the societal norms of who people are. And I don't think I'm the first person that's going to end up in this situation. I don't think I'm the last person. But a lot of people will end up falling down that where they try and change themselves, especially at university. We've all heard the thing, go to uni, you come out woke. That happens. It does actually happen quite a fair amount. And a lot of people will end up with that experience and they will end up rejecting it because they'll just go, that's not who I am in the slightest. But I think it's about self-morale and determination and individualism that you can be able to pull away from those strengths of society and those strengths of social groups and put yourself and prioritize yourself above the need of acceptance by other people.
You talk about this, you've set up this prioritise Britain, and it's ethno-nationalist, that's fair enough, right? It's ethno-nationalist to the extent that there's some quite fun video of you with some black girl saying, oh, you're a great lass, I love you, but you know, I'm going to have to deport you, unfortunately. I will be sad when you are deported. But then Christianity is universalist and seems to argue that the central thing is that you accept Christ as your saviour. And so how the whole notion of Christian nationalism, I'm interested to know, it seems some people would argue that it's almost a bit of a contradiction. How do you fit an ethno-nationalism, which is based around genetics and being part of the shared ancestors, with the notion that people are all one in Christ and as long as they accept Christ as their Lord and saviour, then they're fine and they're part of our group?
Again, this goes back to the flesh and spirituality. So, for example, when God's creating nations and he's creating people to be different, if he wanted us all to be the same, he'd create us all the same. The point of God creating people in certain sectors of the world is so that we can live in those certain sectors of the world. That's not natural to move people into each other, because the reason why people are living in certain parts of the world is because that is their group of people in the flesh. When we're talking about everyone is one under Christ, that is true, but spiritually, we're not all the exact same. We're never made the exact same. It's like, for example, men and women in the Bible are very different creatures, and they have different roles, and that they have different social things. However, under Christ, they are one because spiritually they're both connected by God. So when people go over this and like Bob from Speaker's Corner that says that ethno-nationalism is anti-Christ, I disagree completely because ethno-nationalism is the preservation of the nations. And if God's created nations and people to live within those nations, we should not disrespect his commands by trying to mix everybody together. In fact, that's just completely going against the natural understanding of what the world is.
So who's Bob from Speaker's Corner?
Oh, he's some like Christian evangelist that goes on all the time about why ethno-nationalism's ethno-nationalists are anti-Christ and all of that. But he's just an idiot, to be honest.
But this isn't the guy that's called Young Bob. Isn't there someone called Young Bob?
Yeah, Young Bob as well. But Young Bob, I mean, he talks more about like the understanding of why. If you're going to have a nation, it must be homogenous with like cultural values, ethnic values, and even religious values and those kind of things. And I think that's another good point about it is because, for example, because we're not an ethno state, because we've allowed in swarms of people, say from the Middle East or whatnot, they have brought different religions, which are now creating a more secular society, which is then also creating religious conflicts within these countries. Whereas if a country is homogenous and everybody follows very certain ethnic group and doctrines and religious partakements, then you're not going to have those issues. So I think if you want to respect Christ, because Christ is spiritual, you want to respect God's wishes, everyone should just be in their natural state.
Right, but I don't see how it's a natural state to not migrate when we know that throughout history there have been periods due to various factors that have affected climate and have affected the ability to obtain enough food and whatever, volcanic eruptions, that sort of thing. There have been periods of mass migration. There have been periods of significant migration. There was a time when there were no East Asian people. There was a time when there were no Australian Aborigines. Australian Aborigines came about because people migrated from Southeast Asia to Australia. When it was still attached to the land, and then became separated and devolved to that environment. So I don't really understand what's unnatural about people moving about.
What's unnatural about people moving about is hundreds of thousands to millions of people getting a plane from one side of the world to the other side of the world and settling there and changing a demographic in less than 80 years. I think that's completely unnatural. Natural migration, people always go on about like the whole idea about these the Northwest European tribes that migrated over to the British Isles and, oh, so we must accept a million Indians into this country. Doesn't even make sense because that's a very small level of migration from a very small area of the world. It's very different to modern day migration. And I think no one makes a distinction that modern day migration is quite literally economic migration as well. It's governments employing the hundreds of thousands of people to fly over, be given a piece of paper that says you can stay here, and it is completely eroding demographics. So there's a massive difference from people moving from Southeast Asia down a little bit, from people flying over from, say, Pakistan all the way over to the British Isles and settling with a family.
Well, why? That's just that they're just reflecting industrialization and the fact that industrialization allows a quick movement and easy movement around the world. It's just an outworking of industrialization, which is itself an outworking of the genetics of the people that have managed to industrialize the world.
No, I think it's more globalism, if anything, because what it's actually doing is big multinational corporations sucking up these people as cheap labor. I mean, for example, I think it's about 73% of all non-EU migration into the UK usually ends up as cheap labor. So I think it's very different from industrialization. You can still have homogenous industrialization. China, for example, is homogenous industrialization. It's more different in the UK now because we've moved to a service-based economy, but I also think that does not excuse the fact that we should not be an economic zone at the discredit of our own ethnic group. Our ethnic group should always come first. And if a system of monetary value or production seeks to destroy my people in our own homeland, then that system should be burnt to the ground.
But you can see that if Christian nationalism uses the Bible as its basis for things, you can see that the Bible, as far as I can see, is quite vague. There are things that contradict other things. The books reflect different time periods in which they're written and that sort of thing. And so if you want to, you can interpret it in a way that is against mass migration. And you can talk about, I don't know, white people are the Jews and the books at the end of the Old Testament where they condemn mixing and all this kind of thing. But if you want to, you can equally, you have the basis, particularly from the New Testament, to interpret it when they were a little group that was fighting against the big Romans, and the method they used was purity signaling. The method that was virtue signaling, was basically being left wing. And then once they gained power, the Christians, then they start being group oriented and essentially right wing. So you've got the whole mix there. And it's what your interpretation is just one interpretation of that complex text, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, sure. So they can argue about these kind of understandings of what they interpret the Bible as. And a lot of evangelicals do compare to other people. But what I would say is this is why I moved away from the label of Christian nationalism, because I think a lot of people that would refer to themselves as civic nationalists are now adopting the idea of Christian nationalism, because it allows them to try and coordinate everybody as a child of God, that it doesn't matter who's where as long as they're a Christian. I don't see that as reality. I don't see that as good for nature. I don't see that as good for society. So that's why I don't refer to myself as a Christian nationalist at this current time. I refer to myself as an ethno-nationalist. When we get a homogenous state or an ethno-state, would I want the country to be Christian? Well, yes, of course. But I think that the most important thing to focus on at this point in time is making sure that countries are homogenous. So regardless of people's interpretation, we must recognize that if you want a country and a nation to work in the natural, most cohesive state, it must be homogenous.
Why?
Well, because ethnic groups, so number one, culture is very downstream from ethnicity. I mean, for example, you look at things in like Pakistan, India, they have very different cultural factors. They come over to the UK, especially in mass numbers. They create enclaves, Tower Hamlets. You have the big Muslim gangs that like to roam around there, Alan Rock, Bradford. These areas are nothing more than ethnic enclaves. And because they're ethnic enclaves, it's creating societies within societies. So there's no point importing these hundreds of thousands of millions of people over for them to create their own society here anyway and not mix with us. There's been multiple reports, 2014 Trojan Horse reports, about certain schools in Birmingham that are teaching Islamic material at the exclusion of Christian material. Now, we are supposed to be a Christian nation. So even that is showing that different ethnic groups are bringing over their own form of cultural identity, and it is eroding our cultural identities. If a state's not homogenous, you're going to see different, for example, white people. They are the only group of people that view everybody as relatively the same, whereas every other race will always prefer themselves over every other race. That, again, is this idea of like social cohesion. We can't be offensive. You can't be racist. You can't say that. But it's to our own dismissal, because we are the ones that then end up victims of these more anti-white racism that you keep seeing, with like Wayne Broadhurst being stabbed, Iyana being stabbed in America for the simple basis of being a white person. So if a state's not homogenous, all you're doing is increasing the chances of ethnic divides, of cultural erosion, and of race wars. And I think that's horrendous.
So what would you say about the idea that ethnicity is a category? It's basically based around having shared ancestors, that sort of thing. A genetic family, if you like. So, and sometimes with the notion of a family, we say, well, yeah, you know, our parents and grandparents, yeah, they're part of our family. Brothers and sisters, that's part of our family. Cousins, yeah, okay, they're part of our family. Second cousins, the borderline, really, because some of them you probably haven't even met. And then third cousins, probably that's beyond the border of family in most cases, unless you know them personally and know them well. So even though it's a predictive category, it allows correct predictions to be made genetically, whatever, there are these nebulous borders. You know, for example, you would probably think that your dog was more part of your family than your cousin, even though your dog is a different species. So it's not just about genetics. So how would you deal with those in your ethno-nationalist ideal state? How would you deal with those borders?
Look, so I think it determines on the actual the country and the group in the country. So, for example, England is very, very different from America. People always go on in America about white, because America is a makeup of Europeans, Anglos, Celts, and all of that. Whereas England is mainly just the Anglo people. I mean, considering England's named after the Angles. So I think that when it comes to a country as small as ours, and as ethnically divisive as ours, it needs to be focusing mainly on the ethnic group. So when you're going on about like the different categories of that, when it comes to like Europeans, I think Europeans are our closest brothers. And like, I do align myself with the idea of white identity as well. But I always say my personal point is that our ethnic group should come first. Do I think that we need to be caring about the European brothers? Yes, absolutely, because they fall under the category of our racial group. And as every other racial group does it. I mean, if you go and ask a black person in Africa, do they view their ethnic group or their race? I'll probably say their race, because they view themselves by the common denominator, which is their race. So I think that we do need to be looking out for those things. However, because we are such a small ethnic group in this massive world of loads of other ethnic groups, that needs to be preserved first and foremost.
Well, no, I think in Africa, a lot of people see the most central component of their identity as their tribe.
It depends on the areas of Africa. But, I mean, for example, go to America again.
Yeah, America, America,
they don't really call themselves, the Yaku tribe or any of that. They'll go white or black. That's kind of how it is. Because their society has been so mixed of all of these different groups that they view each other on the racial basis rather than they do the ethnic basis. But I think, again, going back to the smaller countries, Nigeria, for example, yes, you're right about the tribes. They view it because their ethnic groups are a lot smaller compared to the rest of the world.
Fair enough. And how have you found this street activism that you've engaged in, this being an agent provocateur? Has it got you in any serious trouble?
Well, apart from having the police rang on me and stuff like that, it's a risky job, but nothing comes easy in life. So you either do it or you don't. You can sit on your ass inside all the time and just talk to a camera, but it's not the real world and it's not interacting with people. I think if you want to try and interact with the average person, you want to try and make people understand, you've got to go out on the streets. Most people are not a big fan of sitting around and watching an hour-long podcast where you talk about ethnic groups and you talk about certain policies that's eroding your ethnic group, running at that. People want you to go out there and have a conversation with them, because you'll be surprised, but a lot of people actually do agree with what I say. But a lot of people say, yeah, England should be for the English. So it's an interesting job, I'll say that. I mean, my protest that I did the other day had quite a backlash from Antifa and that kind of thing. And you can be in relative danger of certain things, but at the end of the day, if you care enough to spread a message for the care of your people, then you make those risks.
What was your protest the other day?
I was trying to tell people about ethno-nationalism and talking about England for the English and say that we have a right to self-determination and the right to our own homeland and our homogenous people. And Antifa weren't a fan of that.
Well, no, of course not. Do you think that this will happen? Do you think that there'll be something akin to remigration? Do you think it will actually occur?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even on like the very base level where reform's going on about sending back the Boris wave, that is still a form of remigration. But I think remigration will come from a set of policies over a few decades which make people want to leave the country, or in the worst case scenario, ends up having to get people expelled from the country for the protection of our ethnic group. But I think that we're already beginning to see the very beginnings of remigration becoming mainstream policy within our politics.
Well, one of the things that's happening that's very interesting is that the standard of living in, let's say, Poland, relative to the standard of living in the UK, is increasing and has increased markedly. And Polish people and indeed other ethnic groups that have come here from Eastern Europe are returning because of the chaos that they see in the UK. And that chaos, as far as I can see, is substantially because of mass immigration from the Third World. So that's a problem, because those people were quite a hardworking, useful minority that were useful to the economy, and those are the people that are leaving. So,
yeah, I mean, so I guess a more interesting benefit to that is it breaks down our society, and maybe a little bit of accelerism, but I don't think we even need accelerism. I think that just reality itself, you can look outside and realize how horrible our society is now compared to, I mean, I talk to my grandparents all the time, and they say even compared to their teenage years and in their 20s or whatnot, it's just a completely unrecognizable country. And like, look, I think it's interesting because people a lot, they like to talk about Poland and how safe Poland is and how patriotic Poland is. Poland is an ethno state. It's a very homogenous state. The people of Poland are very proud to be Polish, but it's a very white place as well. So I think if people are going to get to a point where they want us to be like Poland, they must understand and recognize that if you want to be like Poland, we have to reverse mass migration, not just the illegal migration, which is a drop in the ocean, not literally, but also the mass migration that we've imported for economic benefits, because all it's actually doing is destroying our economy. People go on and on and on and on about like, oh, immigration is needed to keep up our economy, but GDP per capita continues to go down. The average living standards of the average person in the UK continues to go down. The average income of the average person continues to go down. So I don't even understand how people can correlate that mass migration is good for the economy, because it's not. It's just good for the multinationals that suck them up as cheap labour.
Well, it keeps labour cheap. This is one of the things that was true before Poland joined the EU, was that it was very expensive to get a plumber, for example. Very expensive, because people that should be training to be plumbers would do decadent things like go to university and do some silly degree they didn't need to do. And so there weren't enough plumbers. And so you experience that in Finland, where I live now. that they can charge you whatever they feel like because there's not enough of them. And you don't get the cheap labor here doing that because no one can speak Finnish. So it's protected against that problem until the standard of English is good enough here that people are prepared to have labor in English, which is increasingly happening.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is the thing as well, is because going back to our cultural factors, everybody has to now go to university, apparently. That was introduced under Blair. He was very advocate that every English person should be going to university and all of this. I don't think most people need to go to university. Like, I don't really think that most people that were on my course needed to go to university. I was like, you people would be way better off doing something else, something that's actually useful for you. And I mean, even me, I don't really think necessarily that I needed to go to university, because I've not even used my psychology degree after all. So I think there is this weird culture where everybody's trying to look for the best job that they can get, whereas most people would be better off learning a skill, having
well, Manchester Metropolitan University was founded as a polytechnic, and the idea was to teach people a practical degree in something reasonably technically advanced. The idea was not to do a psychology degree. If you do a psychology, you go to Manchester University. You don't go to Manchester Polytechnic.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of the courses on them are just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, like, even people doing their very basic things like graphic design, you can teach yourself graphic design. It's not difficult to understand how to work Photoshop, but people pay $9,000 a year to go and study these courses and end up in £30,000 worth of debt for no reason when they could have just done something practical. I think that we should be teaching people to do things that are practical. And because of the society we're living in, where people get cheap labor instead and they just get sucked up into a very normal minimum wage job or a 0-hour contract job, they're not going out and learning skills, but they could actually benefit themselves a lot more by going out and learning a skill with these things.
Yes, we can agree on that. Now, I want to move on to something that's slightly sensitive, if I may, which is that you shot to prominence because you filmed an argument with your parents, and it got quite intense. Your mother, from what I can work out, was your mother was on the phone, says, I don't know who, the police, saying, my son is 22 and he's really radicalized. He's really right wing. He's shouting. I wasn't aware that was a police matter, but neither anyway, this is what your mother did. And your father, whom you were filming, said, shut the fuck up, you parasite. What have you become? You will not win this war. Now, watching it out of context, we all wonder, how could it have... do you have siblings, by the way?
I do, yeah. Two.
Where were they?
My brother is at university, so he lives in accommodation. I believe my sister was at a friend's house that night.
So how could you... Would you mind awfully explaining... I hope things have got a bit better now. You say you're in touch with your grandparents, which is good. How did things build to that boiling point?
It's very difficult because I actually don't know. So, look, I have no disrespect to my parents, and I'm sure you can imagine I'm not going to slag off my parents because they're still my parents, and I do have love for them. That's a normal thing. I think the issue is, because they were brought up in a very different society.
Are you in touch? Are you in touch with them now? Has it calmed down now?
It's calmed more now. I'll say that. But the issue is with this kind of situation is, I don't think their generation fully understands me and my generation and like our perspective on society, because even back in the 1970s where they were growing up, it's very different from where we are now in what 2020s. So,
are you ready for the future of the West?
Thank you for listening, and if you'd like to hear the full interview and also help with my other projects, then please become a subscriber at thejollyheretic.com.